Hello, I'm Carolyn Fay. This is number 0622, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it's coming to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0622. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Dean Jobe, who is the author of the true crime novel about a 19th century serial killer called The Case of the Murderous Dr. Cream. Why is it that so many early serial killers were actually in the medical profession?
I quote no lesser authority than Sherlock Holmes from a story that appeared actually at the time Cream was claiming his victims, where he says that a doctor who goes wrong is the first of criminals. He has the nerve and he has the knowledge. Very few doctors do go wrong, but Cream proves that through his knowledge of poisons, and I think just through his cold-bloodedness, being inured to death, I think, as a doctor, once he decided to kill, he became basically a killing machine.
Dr. Anne Andrew, author of What They Don't Teach in Prenatal Class, discusses how the ongoing pandemic is having an effect on the mental health of kids and teens.
COVID is simply a trigger. In and of itself, it doesn't have the power to cause depression or anxiety, but it's our thoughts about the pandemic that cause the anxiety and the depression that we're seeing in just huge numbers in teenagers, and actually all kids.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, we examine how Los Angeles became a music, TV, movie, and political hub way back in 1974 in Rock Me on the Water. So don't be a dingbat, Edith. It's all happening later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0622, was the lovely and talented Carolyn Fay, an extremely talented artist here in Montreal. She's a singer and actress. She will have a new EP coming out soon. In the meantime, she just finished shooting a Lionsgate movie with Anna Kendricks and has been doing cartoon voices for a new series in both French and English. And she's just added playwright as a new feather to her already feathery cap. A lovely person indeed. Thank you very much, Carolyn, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. And by the way, anyone can go to her website. All you have to do is go to the show number for this program, which you just heard her mention. See how it goes around full circle? And you'll find the link to her website. Thank you very much for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In Santa Ana, California, on July 13th, firefighters responded to a building where a woman was wedged naked between the concrete walls of two buildings. Workers at a nearby body shop had heard the woman screaming but couldn't figure out where she was. Said one worker, "The cops came in and got on the roof and looked between the two walls, and she's all naked. She was screaming in pain. She was upside down, too." The space was less than a foot wide, and firefighters had to cut a hole in the concrete and pull her out. As for how she got there, Orange County Fire Authority Captain Than Nguyen said, "It's a mystery to all of us here right now." Well, maybe she was born between the walls and had a rapid aging syndrome, just like in the new M. Night Shyamalan movie, Old.
Oh, no. We're here for a reason.
In theaters July 23rd. Check your local listings.
27-year-old Louis Angelino III of Barrington, New Jersey, works at a liquor store, but lately he's been cleaning friends' houses to make some extra cash. One day in June, Angelino was scheduled to clean the home of his friend Mark. He showed up, found the key under the mat, and spent 2.5 hours making the townhouse sparkle. That's when Mark called him to see if he had been able to get the job done, and Angelino said, "I'm literally in your living room right now playing with your cats." But Mark replied, "Louis, I don't have any cats." Turns out Angelino had written down the wrong address and tidied up a neighbor's home instead. Mark left a note for Tom and Beth Modzel explaining the mix-up. Tom arrived home before his wife and called her saying, "You won't believe it. Someone broke into our house and cleaned the entire thing, Swiffer and all."
Swiffer's the one, it's the better way to get it done.
Beth has dubbed Angelino the cleaning fairy, and his business is now taking off. So I guess you could say he's cleaning up. Well, Stuff File program listeners may remember this story from 2 years ago. Mark Edwin Turner, who at the time was 56, of Bedford County, Virginia, got into a heated argument with his fiancée's son over what type of vehicle was best, Chevy versus Ford. Do you remember this story? Well, if you recall, Turner went into the house and returned with a gun and shot the younger man in the arm, and also shot his fiancée, who tried to shield her son 5 times. Now, both survived. Turner has now been sentenced to 2 counts of malicious wounding, 10 years in prison with all but 12 months suspended and 3 years of probation. Now, the judge also ordered restitution and for Turner to have no contact with the young man. Here's the latest twist. It seems Tracy Bailey, his then fiancée, forgave Turner. During the 2 years the case wound through the court system, she married him. Let me repeat that. She married the man who shot her 5 times. Now, did Tracy not have any pause at the for better or worse part of the vows? Did Mark get her a ring? You know, some sort of precious metal other than 5 pieces of lead? The unanswered question, does her son allow her to have any contact with him? Boy, when this guy gets out of jail in about 2 years, Thanksgiving dinner at that household is going to be fraught with peril. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a 9-year-old by the name of Ernie had upwards of 8,000 followers on Instagram. Then his social media manager, 50-year-old Irene Wong of Vallejo, California, made a mistake. She put his actual date of birth on his profile. Instagram bans everyone under 13 from having an account on the site, so it promptly took away Ernie's, who went from Instagram to Instagon. Wong thought Ernie deserved a special exception because she was the one posting his pictures, and also because Ernie is a cat. Wong pleaded to get the account back, even launching a hashtag campaign, but she was unsuccessful until a TV station intervened. Well, please note that Instagram is owned by the same pinheads who also own and run Facebook, a social media platform that doesn't really seem to understand the social dynamics of human beings or cats. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dean Jobe is an award-winning author and journalist and a professor at the University of King's College in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He's also into true crime. In fact, he's the author of a monthly true crime column called Stranger Than Fiction for Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and he's the author of The Case of the Murderous Dr. Cream. Dr. Cream was one of the first international serial killers. Dean joins us on the line from Nova Scotia. Hi, Dean.
Hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. What is it about, at least in early history, what is it about serial killers who are also doctors?
Well, I quote no lesser authority than Sherlock Holmes from a story that appeared actually at the time Cream was claiming his victims. where he says that a doctor who goes wrong is the first of criminals. He has the nerve and he has the knowledge. Very few doctors do go wrong, but Cream proves that through his knowledge of poisons, and I think just through his cold-bloodedness, being inured to death, I think, as a doctor, once he decided to kill, he became basically a killing machine.
As I said in the introduction, he became one of the first international serial killers, and that's something, that's a term you don't hear very often. I was always under the assumption that serial killers basically stuck close to home, but that's not the case with Dr. Cream.
No, and I think it's surprising too, the era. We're talking the 1870s to the 1890s. Cream was grew up in Canada, and that's where he got his medical degree. He started killing women very soon after graduating. Many of them were patients who came to him seeking illegal abortions. This was a service he provided, but along the way, he also decided some of these patients would die. And it is remarkable that he was able to kill in Canada. When he became a suspect in a death here, he fled to Chicago, set up a new practice, killed four more times, ultimately went to prison for one of those murders. But when he was released 10 years later, he went to London, England, and killed again. So it was a really remarkable series of murders. And when I set out to tell his story, my central question was, how could this happen? How could this figure who was often a suspect in so many crimes or was charged or even convicted, how could he have been freed to kill and kill again and in so many different places?
Well, even going back to the time period when there wasn't exactly something called compassionate release, how does someone who gets convicted of a murder get out of jail within 10 years?
Well, there was a lot of corruption in the justice system in Illinois at the time, and Cream seems to have benefited from that. He was imprisoned for life. He could have been hanged because he was convicted of murder in 1881. This was actually his sixth murder. From the research I've done, no doubt that he had killed six times by then. He was supposed to serve a life sentence, but it was, if you had people on the outside who would vouch for you, and Cream's family did try to push for his release after he'd served 10 years, he was able to get some fairly powerful political backing. And my research, I think, does prove that money changed hands, that there was corruption and bribery involved to get him out in 1891. I mean, the people who fought for his release did not expect he would go on to kill again, but that is unfortunately what happened.
You mentioned his family vouched for him as well. Was he married? Did he have children? And I'm asking because, does he have descendants?
I did try to trace his family tree, and there don't seem to be very many direct descendants. He didn't have any children. His first victim, actually, was a young woman he was engaged to, and this was in 1876 in Quebec. And she became pregnant. He performed an abortion, almost killed her, but was forced to marry her. And months later, started sending her medicine that later on her doctor came to suspect was poison because she died soon afterwards. But the doctor didn't report it at the time, and it was just another example of the kinds of breaks that Cream got. He was either above suspicion because he was a doctor, or he simply was able to accuse others or deflect blame. He didn't leave any direct family descendants. He had no children.
When it comes to murderers, stereotypically, people often say that men will use weapons or instruments and women will use poison. Is it unusual that you have a serial killer, albeit a doctor, who is a male who uses poison?
Well, there were a lot of, one of the accounts I consulted talked about in England being one doctor every year convicted of some form of murder. And it was common for doctors who did what Crean did, who performed illegal abortions. It was common for them, if their patients died, to be charged with murder. So that accounted for some of it. And that gets into the desperation of women in Victorian society who could not, who would be stigmatized forever if they had a child out of wedlock. But it's a good point about poison is not necessarily a man's choice of weapon. But in Crean's case, part of his medical training was learning how to compound his own medicines, because doctors did in those days. And he knew strychnine was used, and that was his weapon of choice, his poison of choice. Strychnine was used in trace amounts in medicines. It had some benefits, but only in minute quantities. But he knew exactly how much a lethal dose would be. And really, tragically and chillingly in this case, as a doctor, he knew exactly the kind of excruciating death he was condemning his victims to suffer.
I mentioned in the introduction your background as writing the true crime column called Stranger Than Fiction for the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. What was it about Dr. Crean, though, that made you decide, I need to do a full-fledged book on this guy?
Well, I think it was the two things. One was just simply the scale of his crimes, and on three different countries. And what that said about the state of policing at the time, as I mentioned, my central question, how did he get away with it so many places for so long? I do quite a bit of research, articles as well as books. So I guess I'm sort of diving into newspaper accounts in that period for various research projects I've got underway. And he's someone who's hard to escape. His case was obviously a sensation at the time. And I think I was intrigued by the fact that despite the scale of what he did and the brutality and how well known he was at the time, he's largely been forgotten today. I saw that as a challenge, and also the challenge of trying to do the definitive story of the scale of his crimes and how he got away with it.
You spent a lot of time researching this book. You also did a lot of traveling, going to the archives in the U.S., Canada, and England. What was, for you, someone who knew a little bit about this guy before you even started, what was for you the biggest aha moment when you were doing your research?
There were a series of them. When I started out, there were some secondary. I mean, a Crean story had been told over time, but not for several decades. And so the first thing I started to do was look for gaps. And I was delighted, obviously, when I found court files that had been overlooked in the past, where some earlier researchers had looked at one newspaper account of his trial. In Chicago, for instance, there were a half dozen newspapers, so I tried to assemble them all. So various times I would find some new fact. One was that he had been born in Scotland, although raised in Canada. He still had a Scottish accent, and one time one journalist noted that. So I collected sort of these little gems, I guess, of new insights. To open some of these files that are still in the original courthouses where Crean was tried, and to realize that no one had really looked at this evidence, looked at this information for more than a century was quite something. I mean, it brings the past alive, I think, when you connect with it like that. And as a journalist, I'm always looking for a scoop. So I was always very grateful when I delighted when I found something that I knew had never been unearthed as part of his story.
When anybody talks about the late 1800s and a serial killer who may have been in the United States, Britain, and Canada, everyone seems to think, well, is this another person who could have been Jack the Ripper? I know Herman Webster Mudgett is also suspected of being a doctor who's Jack the Ripper. Is Crean ever thought to be a suspect, or is he in a different category altogether?
Well, strangely, for decades he was. Whenever you'd see a newspaper, a press account of Jack the Ripper, maybe a sidebar on who could it have been, Crean's name would pop up, which is very strange because he was in prison in Illinois in the fall of 1888 when Jack the Ripper's crimes were committed. There were parallels that were noted at the time. I mean, Crean preyed on sex workers in London, so did the Ripper. But, I mean, a poisoner versus someone who slashed his victims brutally, I mean, the methods weren't the same. But strangely, the myth developed that maybe somehow Crean had bought his way out of prison earlier than people thought, which I know isn't true because I've seen the records. But if he somehow got there, could he have been Jack the Ripper? It seems to have been fueled by an early newspaper account a decade after his trial that suggested when he was executed for murder finally in 1892 that his last words on the scaffold were, "I am Jack the," and the trap was sprung as if, was he just about to confess to being Jack the Ripper? It's a fanciful tale, never talked about at the time of the execution. No one ever recalled hearing this. But over time, that has morphed and snowballed into almost a conspiracy theory, really, that perhaps Crean could have been the Ripper. I do deal with it in the book, and I think definitively I can say that he had an ironclad alibi. He was in Joliet prison in Illinois at the time.
A fascinating story indeed. The book is The Case of the Murderous Dr. Crean. Dean, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you.
Dean Jobe, author of The Case of the Murderous Dr. Crean. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0622, and you'll find links to Dean's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to Dr. Ann Andrew about the pandemic isolation on children and teens. Plus, Stuart Nelman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We do indeed have an idiot of the day and more in Stuff File News here in a program that's heard everywhere for all your devices on everything from Spotify to iHeartRadio to Apple to Google Podcasts, just to name a few. And now, portions of the program can be heard on the new audio service called Audea. That's A-U-D-E-A, a platform that allows you to listen to segments of audio much in the same way that YouTube allows you to watch videos. There, you'll get to hear some fresh conversations from Stuff File program shows, and you'll also get a chance to go back into our archives and hear chats that go all the way back to 2009. Right now, there are about 450 items up there from the Stuff File program. So check it out. The new service is Audea, and you can get to it by going to audea.io. That's audea.io. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Okay, here's a story that I'll tell you right off the bat, I just don't get. On July 3rd, Andover Township, New Jersey police received a call about a dead body found under a deck in the town. The detective and officers began to check the area under the deck when they did indeed confirm a deceased human body was contained within a doghouse. 2 days later, 25-year-old Brian Chetta Hackenbrush and 27-year-old Matthew R. Thomas were arrested for disturbing or desecrating human remains, but not with murder. It appears the deceased was a resident of Hoppetcong, New Jersey, who died from a medical emergency. Now, young Brian and Matthew placed the body in the trunk of a car belonging to the victim, then called the towing company to have the car moved to Andover. Then the two allegedly moved the body to the doghouse belonging to an unsuspecting family. Police didn't clarify the relationship of the victim to the suspects or any motives for their elaborate plan. Well, if it's a prank on the unsuspecting family, then it's far more elaborate than flaming dog feces on their doorstep, but I digress. In any case, those two have a lot of explaining to do. And speaking of dead bodies, just because a warning is ridiculous doesn't mean that it's not needed. Case in point, the crematorium and memorial group in Bishop Auckland, County Durham, England, is asking families to be more careful with what they put in with their loved ones' bodies that are then cremated. Now, some items damage the crematorium or injure a colleague, causing a delay to other families' funerals, they said. Like what, you ask? Glad you did. Bottles of alcoholic beverages and cell phones or other battery-powered devices can explode, they say, and plastics can create poisonous fumes. One particularly noted no-no? Bowling balls. No, seriously. Bowling balls. You know, the safest thing to put in a coffin with a loved one is a get-out-of-hell-free card, as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, moving right along, conditions at Gold Hills Golf Club in Redding, California, may be just a tad too dry. An unnamed golfer hit a ball into the rough and took a swing at it to get it back onto the green. As he was walking away, he happened to look back, and the spot where he took his swing was on fire. He ran back and tried to stomp out the flames, but they spread too rapidly for him to handle. Firefighters were able to get the fire under control, but it still consumed about an acre of vegetation. "It's just that dry," said a Redding Fire Department investigator, noting the golfer's club had apparently hit a stone, creating a spark. Wow. 2021. The year golfers start hoping to end up in a water hazard. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, an unnamed couple in New Zealand appealed the payout from their insurance company after a fire burned down their house. The $418,000 paid was $200,000 short of the rebuilding cost. That's what they told the Insurance and Financial Services Ombudsman. IFSO turned down the appeal. That's the amount they insured their house for, not rebuilding costs, so it was the maximum payout possible. Now, normally I would feel for the unfortunate homeowners who either didn't understand the difference between policies that cover the value of the property versus policies that cover replacement value, or if they couldn't afford the more expensive policy and they just took a chance. I get it. It's heartbreaking when you lose everything and you don't have the means to replace it all. But in the case of this pinhead, all empathy goes out the window when you consider the cause of the fire. The husband put a steak on to cook, and then headed out to a fish and chips joint to buy fries to go with it. And by the time he got back, the home was fully engulfed in flames. Did he leave the steak on the stove in a skillet? Nope. Did he leave the steak in the oven? Nope. Did he leave the steak cooking in a fireplace? Nope. Did he have an outdoor barbecue indoors? No. Dumb as that would be, that would still be smarter than what he did. The husband put a steak on to cook in a toaster. And not a toaster oven, a regular slip-in-some-slices-of-bread toaster. Said insurance counsel CEO Tim Grafton, cooking steak in a toaster is literally a recipe for disaster. Yeah. And I'll bet it's served with a side of regret. You know, for a split second, I thought about naming this guy the idiot of the day, and he really was close to earning that accolade. But no, I have a bigger winner, and that comes later, so stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We've had author and educator Dr. Anne Andrew on the program before. She's the author of What They Don't Teach in Prenatal Class, The Key to Raising Trouble-Free Kids and Teens. Back in 2019, we talked about several things, including suicide prevention among teens. So I thought we should have her back on the show to talk a little about any signs of mental health that a parent might notice about their kids when it comes to dealing with the pandemic, the lockdowns, and the changes that this has all brought to a teenager's social life, or lack thereof. Anne joins us via Skype from Vancouver. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Peter. Good to be back.
Nice to have you back on the program with us. So, as I said in the preamble there, what are some of the signs, and are they any different than what we talked about when we discussed suicide prevention 2 years ago?
Right. And what we were doing with talking about suicide prevention was really looking at the negative beliefs that kids develop at a very young age, long before they're teenagers, actually, and that those negative beliefs that they pick up really drive their thoughts, their feelings, and their behaviors. Those beliefs really are there from a very young age, and COVID is simply a trigger. In and of itself, it doesn't have the power to cause depression or anxiety, but it's our thoughts about the pandemic that caused the anxiety and the depression that we're seeing in just huge numbers in teenagers. In actually all kids, there's a study out of Sick Kids Hospital in Toronto looking at the mental health of kids in Ontario that shows that 70% of school-age kids, right from age 6, and 66% of preschool kids are showing signs of depression, anxiety, irritability, hyperactivity, and obsessive behaviors, which is a huge crisis, a serious and sustained effect on the mental health of our young people.
As someone who has studied this, are those statistics something that surprises you, or was this to be expected as far as you were concerned?
It doesn't surprise me at all. I think that what COVID has done in lots of ways, it's very positive. It's put a spotlight on mental health. Mental health has been a huge issue for a long time, but it hasn't got the attention that it deserves. And now it's really showing that what we're doing isn't working. Everything needs to change about the way we educate kids and what we really see as priorities in a child's life. And I think that really helping them with understanding their feelings and emotions, where they come from. And of course, the most important thing really, or the biggest factor in a healthy mental health development in children is how their parents cope with their own mental health. Are they taking care of their mental health? That is the biggest predictor of successful, mentally healthy children.
Are parents between a rock and a hard place when it comes to trying to parent through this pandemic, when it comes to things like, for instance, social media and their devices? You know, everyone talks about how we have to limit kids' uses of social media and devices. Yet during a lockdown, during a pandemic, that's the only way that these young people who are creatures of and need social interaction can have that social interaction.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that screen time during the pandemic really went from being the villain to being something that was positive in some ways. And certainly it depends how screen time is being used. We do know that too much screen time has negative effects on mental health and can cause hyperactive behavior and obsessiveness. It is an addiction like any other. However, it does have positive sides to it. That was how teens were able to connect during the pandemic with other kids. I think a really good conversation to have with teens is, what are those connections about? Are those connections to fill an empty space or to help with boredom? Are they there to distract from uncomfortable feelings? Or are they actually there to share inspiration? And so really looking at those connections and which relationships are nourishing and which are just there to distract, and helping kids realize that even without physical connection, they can go inwards to find a place of peace and calm. They don't need to be distracted constantly by external factors. And I think that is something that parents can model for their kids, is how do they cope with their difficult feelings?
One of the studies I saw out of the United States, they had a poll of about 1,000 parents of teenagers between the ages of 13 and 18 years old. And the results that they found suggested that 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 5 teen boys have experienced new or worsening anxiety because of this whole pandemic situation. If this survey, this poll is to be believed, why do you think it affects girls more than boys?
Girls do seem to be predisposed to depression. Some of that might be hormonal. I'm not 100% sure the differences. I know that perhaps girls talk about it more. Boys might be less willing to come forward with that information. But I do know that it affects both genders, and we have to really pay attention to it.
Yeah, and again, going a little deeper, the results of that survey said that parents were concerned more about their girls than their boys because of the increased anxiety and worry, or depression and sadness. That's what they were concerned with. Are you saying are you saying that basically it's just a situation where the boys are just hiding it better because, you know, even though we live in a different age now, there's still that holdover from previous generations, you know, just buck it up, be a man up kind of thing?
I think there may be a bit of that, but I do know that girls certainly feel a lot of pressure socially to look right, to eat right, to have the right kind of body. That there's a lot of pressure on girls to do everything, to be smart as well as be able to please everybody. So I think that there is a little bit of that social media has really made girls need to be camera ready at every moment. And I think that there's a lot of pressure for them to look right and to have that perfect lifestyle, at least on Facebook or in Instagram, whichever other platforms they're on.
Even if you could wave a magic wand and the world would be back to normal, or at least as close to normal as it was before this whole thing started, do you feel that because of what we went through in the last year and a half, that in some cases, the damage is already done when it comes to teens?
No, I think that the positive, we need to look at some positives and really help them understand that we can use adverse situations as catalysts for self-awareness, becoming self-aware, for looking within for the strength that exists there, and talk about feelings with them. And when they do have these big, scary feelings or disappointments, what can they do to find a place within themselves that feels strong and calm? And by helping them with meditation, mindfulness, even, you know, suggesting gratitude habits. When we're being grateful, it's very difficult to be grumpy or anxious. Gratitude does a lot of really positive things for mental health in lots of ways, and physical health as well. There are some very simple things that we can do that help teens with stress. Even just smiling at them more often. Smiling is just a very simple gift of love from one person to another. It takes a second. And of course, we haven't seen smiling faces because everyone's been behind a mask, except online. But things like that, and that would help a lot with little kids too.
Something you alluded to earlier in the conversation, you talked about the anxiety levels of the parents themselves. Is it very important for the parents to be completely aware, especially if they're concerned about their children, be completely aware of whatever they're giving off themselves as far as anxiety is concerned that the child might be picking up?
Yes, that's the most important thing that a parent can do, is to take care of their own anxiety. Worry achieves nothing. Worrying about kids can give them the message that they're not safe, that they're not capable. And these are hidden messages and subconscious. The very best thing any parent can do for a child is to take care of their own anxious feelings and demonstrate, you know, rather than coming home or being at home and pouring a glass of wine and sitting in front of Netflix, rather say, I think I'm going to go meditate for 10 minutes, or I'm going to write in my gratitude journal, so that they're just demonstrating the ways that they are able to process their feelings and talk about it with kids. because their feelings are really coming from their own early childhood memories in which they may have had an incident in which they felt very unsafe.
Great tips indeed. The book is called What They Don't Teach in Prenatal Class. Also, I understand people can go to your website because you have online courses?
That's correct.
What will people learn in the online courses?
It's actually very much the same as my book, in that they learn how to understand child behavior, and they'll learn about those negative beliefs that kids pick up at such a young age and will have picked up through COVID as well. They learn how to love unconditionally. It's not as easy as it sounds, and we actually have to undo some of the negative beliefs that we have about ourselves in order to be able to love fully and not have it just be a kind of a bargaining. And also how to raise kind kids. Kindness, actually really focusing on kindness, is another really positive thing that you can do to reading on grades, which of course is anxiety producing. So I would really encourage parents to give their teens a lot of space, a lot of leeway, not go running to tutors to get them back on track to get into Harvard Law School. They don't need that. What we really want is a happy, healthy, kind generation, and that's what we can do when we really do our inner work.
Great advice. Thank you very much, Anne, for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you.
Dr. Anne Andrew, author of What They Don't Teach in Prenatal Class, The Key to Raising Trouble-Free Kids and Teens. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this program, which is show number 0622, and you'll find links to Anne's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And I can barely see him through the smog, but here he is once again, Stuart Nallman. How you doing, Stu?
Good times in it. Well, first of all, keeping your head above water, making your way that you can. Ain't we lucky we got them? Dun, 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 dun. Good times, yeah.
Why?
Well, it was either that or my Richard Nixon impersonation.
Oh, wow, there's a choice.
Yeah.
And death wasn't on the menu? That's another option?
No, I'm afraid not.
Oh, okay. So, seriously, why the theme song to Good Times?
Well, Good Times was one of the hit shows that you probably watched in the fall of 1974.
Yes.
You probably did. And Richard Nixon was one of the main characters who's, how can I say, not of the sitcom, but in the news, because his resignation is probably one of the top stories of 1974.
Okay.
Because the year of 1974, Peter, was a tumultuous, if not transitional, year in modern history. Yes, we had the Watergate scandal that was spreading like wildfire and ended up scorching Richard Nixon's presidency. The newspaper heiress Patty Hearst was kidnapped by a French militant group called the Symbionese Liberation Army, or the SLA. North America was recovering from an energy crisis that arose as a result of the 1973 Yom Kippur War in the Middle East. The Miami Dolphins, Philadelphia Flyers, and Oakland A's dominated the sports world by winning their respective pro sports championships. It was what many people say was a year that when the 60s officially ended and the 70s began with a bang. But however, for a brief shining moment, the year 1974 became a revolutionary year in TV, movies, rock music, and politics, and it was all germinating from its somewhat obvious nucleus, the city of Los Angeles, the city of angels.
The one you couldn't see because of all of the smog.
That's right. It was just way too thick.
Yeah, there was a Hollywood sign somewhere up in the hills, but no one could tell.
I remember when it was just called Hollywoodland.
Yes. Well, actually, you remember, or you were... You learned that like I did, because neither one of us are old enough to know that.
Yes, exactly. You know why the land disappeared? Well, all that fog. It was all that fog. But during those landmark 12 months, LA's entertainment and political scene woke up from its stodgy predecessors during the 50s and 60s, and its creations transformed the way we were entertained and how its leaders governed. It was basically a world created by a mostly younger generation that was aimed at its peers to consume and absorb. And yet, no sooner had it started, this remarkable LA-based cultural and political transformation ended its run by the time 1975 rolled around. However, its legacy has been long remembered and far-reaching, and is fondly recalled in CNN political analyst Ronald Brownstein's book, Rock Me on the Water. By the way, that's an actual title from a Jackson Brown song, in case you wanted to know. But this book reads like a stage play in which the acts are each month of 1974, and its scenes involve the four disciplines that Brownstein has made its focus. There's music, where a new California sound emerged from a mix of rock, country, and folk, thanks to Jackson Brown, Linda Ronstadt, and the Eagles, all under the guidance of David Geffen and its newly formed record label Asylum Records. In movie, there's Roman Polanski, Robert Towne, and Jack Nicholson, whose Watergate parable film noir Chinatown is about to be released on an unsuspected movie-going public. And Warren Beatty, who is in the middle of shooting the memorable dramedy Shampoo that would try to make sense of the late 1960s on the night Nixon was first elected president. In TV, there's Norman Lear, the veteran writer and producer, who is on top of the television world as the creative force behind such socially relevant sitcoms as Good Times, which I sang the theme just earlier.
Yes, that, you don't have to remind us. Yes, yes.
Just in case you need that reference.
No, it's like PTSD now.
Dynamite. And Sanford and Son, one of my favorite shows, Maude, The Jeffersons, and his flagship show, All in the Family, which by 1974 was at the peak of its popularity and was about to experience its fourth year in a row as the number one rated TV show in America. And with great support from The Mary Tyler Moore Show and MASH, viewers were learning how to laugh and be reflective at the same time about the issues these sitcoms were presenting. And in politics, California voters were witnessing how local and state politics were leaving the stodgy old school style of LA Mayor Sam Yorty and Governor Ronald Reagan, thanks to future Mayor Tom Bradley, future Governor Jerry Brown, and the anti-Vietnam War activism of Jane Fonda and Tom Hayden.
We're only allowed to mention Linda Ronstadt once, though, okay? So.
Okay, and that was it.
Yeah, so. Well, let's not bring up the Jerry Brown reference.
No. And there's plenty of that interconnection in the book.
Oh, yeah.
But this is not just a regurgitation of familiar facts on the events of this transitional year. Brownstein uses his journalistic acumen to great extent as he gives the reader the background story of each of these scenes and the players that are involved from their difficult starts and rocky roads that brought them to their respective pinnacles of influence. And he does that with a great deal of attention to details and research as we find out how these players slowly rose up from obscurity and mediocrity to all that fame. So finally, Rock Me on the Water is a fascinating panoramic look at how a generation that protested what was wrong with America during the 60s managed to exert their influence on what we watched, listened to, and voted for from their base in the City of Angels. That's such a far-reaching ripple effect, only to lose that vital grasp on the society that they helped to create after only 12 short months on top of the mountain.
So again, this book is?
It's called Rock Me on the Water by Ronald Brownstein, and it's published by Harper, and it's $36.99.
And what other books do you suggest in this genre?
Well, regarding entertainment in the 70s, I have two great suggestions. First, there's Easy Rider's Raging Bulls by Peter Biskind. He chronicles how Hollywood woke up in the 70s from the last of the studio system, which was showing its age, and how it showed its influence through movies like Easy Rider, from Easy Rider to Raging Bull. Great book. And it's done in the style that Ronald Brownstein does in Rock Me on the Water. And one coffee table book, which is very, it's not just your average illustrated coffee table book. It's called The Stewardess is Flying the Plane, and it's a great illustrated history of the movies of the 70s. Now, if you are a film buff and you've seen your share of films, Peter, during the decade like I have, you know where this title came from.
There are several to choose from, but I'm certain that a certain Miss Black is involved.
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it's from Airport 1975.
Yep.
Which was released in late 1974.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great illustrated book and well written about the history of the movies of the 70s and their influence. And like I said, some great illustrations as well. And Karen Black's on the cover.
Of course she is.
Of course. Just thought I'd let you know.
Of course she is. You know, with her cross eyes and Barbra Streisand's cross eyes, if they were standing in front of each other, could they see each other?
Maybe from one side, and that's it.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, this week's book again is?
It's called Rock Me on the Water by Ronald Brownstein. It's published by Harper, and it's $36.99.
And where can we find you? I'm assuming it's not on the corner of Hollywood and Vine.
No, and it's not even at 704 Hauser Street. It's in the pages of the Montreal Times every week. You can read it either in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Thank you, Peter. And now back to watch an earthquake incense around.
Oh, I have a story about that. I was working at the theater where that was playing. And after that movie played, the theater was sold. Because there was some structural damage that took place to the building because of the sensor round and the way it rumbled five times a day for months. So, yeah, that was the beginning of the end for that.
There was only one other movie that used it called Midway, and when I saw it, they stopped using it.
Yeah, at least Midway was playing in Montreal at what was then a relatively brand new theater.
Yes.
But
yes,
I right. digress. Anyway, thank you very much, Stu, for being on the program with us once again.
You're welcome.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We have one more Stuff File news story to get to before we get to our idiot of the day here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, an Omaha man's desire for his wife burned a little too hot, setting his house on fire. Well, maybe it wasn't exactly desire, probably more like spite, but spite can get pretty hot too. It all started when firefighters responded to a house fire at around 11:30 p.m. According to an Omaha Police Department report, a woman outside the home, speaking through an interpreter, told police that her husband set the fire. Apparently, 36-year-old Gilberto Garcia had spent the evening arguing with his wife. The fact that he had been drinking all night probably didn't help either. The woman said that when she went to bed, her husband followed her and began making sexual advances. After spurning her husband's advances, the woman went back to sleep only to be awakened by the smell of smoke. She told police that she found her husband in a bathroom closet setting fire to her clothes. It seems no fight is too bad as to preclude a little nookie. The woman and her three children got out of the house and she called 911. Firefighters determined that a fire in a closet had been intentionally set, and Garcia has been charged with first-degree arson. He faces up to 50 years in prison if convicted of the felony charge. Boy, when he sobered up and realized that his next roommate would probably be a guy named Bubba, I bet that certainly cooled off his libido. Meanwhile, his wife has a good excuse to go out and get a whole new wardrobe. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents The Idiot of the Day.
A woman who was wanted for accessory to murder was arrested one day after commenting on a police department's social media post. The Tulsa Police Department posted to Facebook asking the public for information on Lorraine Graves, who detectives say was involved in a homicide investigation at an apartment complex in March. To the police department's surprise, Graves commented on the post asking about reward money. Detectives arrested Graves on the accessory to murder charge. If convicted, she could be sentenced to up to 45 years in prison. Now, why, oh why, would you contact police on social media about reward money for information into a murder that you were a part of? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0622. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0622. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. We leave you with this deep environmental thought. If we don't do something about global warming soon, eventually there won't be any ice floes left to put our elders on.